Actually, pushing for an exit too early is like very, very harmful and honestly kind of self-destructive. And that's because companies just want to be sold. You know, like that's
right.
Like every startup founder's dream is to get an exit. And so the irony is that the exit is not actually the end game. It's what happens after the exit, and it might be years after the exit that is the end game.
Diving into an episode that is going to inspire you with tales of growth and scaling from one of our guests. Today's guest is going to be special because we hand select people who are actively building and growing their businesses, people who know what it feels like to be in your position. As a listener of this podcast, trying to figure out what your next growth steps are, and they're going to share with us those insights, that journey, and what they're doing right now to position themselves in a better place for growth and scaling. So check it out if you haven't done so already and subscribe to our channel. We are bringing some awesome business leaders into your circle, into your headphones, into your computer monitor today to show you what you can be doing to grow and scale your business. Share the love, subscribe to the channel, and at the end of this episode, to see what you should be doing next to grow and scale your business. Hey, welcome back to the show. I'm so excited today to have my friend Sean with me. You're going to love the topic, and I'm going to let Sean bring it home for us. But Sean, who are you and what do you do with your business?
All right. So I'm Sean. I'm happy to be here. I currently manage GZI, which is an alternative financial data engineering platform that works with boutiques and smaller investment houses.
Nice.
I can get a little bit more into the journey and everything else, but at this point, I'm open to whatever questions you have and happy to answer.
Yeah, well, talk to me about who the client is. So you're talking about a small investment house. Like, how small are we talking about? Like, how big of a fund?
A fund, probably 10 to 100 million. So relatively small. Like, these are not very
right.
large for funds. And usually less than 20 people. And that's on like the upwards of 10 million side.
Perfect. And in an investment house like this, what is their problem that you're solving? And how did you come up with this solution? And just kind of walk us through that journey. I mean, why them? Why are you helping them? And what is it that you do for them?
Okay. So first of all, I personally identify with them. So I started off like running like a very, very small fund before we built this out as a full corporation. And
nice.
Then also, these were the companies that like I started talking to way back in 2020, you know, during a tech accelerator. And so all of the initial customer interviews goes back to, you know, essentially the same group of people. And
right.
it's a lot easier for the smaller funds and boutiques to sort of be outgunned. Like their clientele is very,
for
very
sure.
different from something like JP Morgan Chase. But at the same time, you know, it's a little more cutthroat on the boutique and small fund side. And so they have a different set of needs in terms of development and tech.
For sure. And so what does the tech do that kind of catches them up to speed with the bigger guys?
So it replicates the returns. And so whereas a lot of these larger banks, you know, like they will have, you know, an entire department, if not multiple departments, you know, doing the development and everything else, you know, these companies may have, you know, a handful of people, if not, you know, maybe two or three. And so
right.
they need things condensed in a way that's equally as efficient, but a little bit more streamlined and easier to use with less work.
And so what are you talking about? Like, you're talking about crunching numbers, you're talking about doing analytics on competition. Like, what is it, the data that you're trying to crunch, and what are you trying to deliver to the investors?
That, so the data I'm trying to crunch, that's a whole different world. I mean, so there are mountains, terabytes of data out there in a billion different directions and fields. And we mix and match between, you know, various sources. And so, you know, if you ever read on things like financial AI, you know, they have like five
right.
different data structures. Alternative data is one of them. Fundamental analysis is another one of them. And then, you know, there are things like analyst ratings and everything else that sort of get factored in between them. And
okay.
so we try to condense it. And so instead of people having to actually read through reports or, you know, check things themselves, like we'll algorithmically pre-screen, push the outputs to an interface, or sort of give them an API that will stream the data from our existing database. And so there's no need to actually do any of the reports, there's no need to review them. And so things are basically pre-screened, and, you know, like the trading logs and everything else have been reviewed in multiple rounds of due diligence. And so, you know, we like to believe that, you know, it's accurate, although I'm not going to claim to be the next Jim Simons, because I think that's arrogant as hell. But fingers crossed.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So for a fixed cost, an investor can plug data into you in terms of who they're researching, who they're trying to do their due diligence, is what you're saying. And what you're trying to do is simplify the due diligence phase by doing all the search for them, checking against competition, like running through all the different databases, and essentially doing the work of two teams or multiple teams, all using AI.
Yeah. And so that's the beauty of AI, is that now AI is at the point where you can have AI command other AI to sort of build it out. It's like one model teaches the other model what to do. And it's sort of like, you know, expands until there's like this mushroom cloud of AI.
Right.
And so primarily for equities data at this point, I think we may start building out other things for commodities data or cryptocurrencies. But the thing is that like when it comes to like actual stock investing, there are a slew of factors. And then also, you know, any given exchange, there may be, you know, tens of thousands of individual stocks, and probably more if you're including ETFs. And it depends on the country, it depends on the exchange within the country, and so on and so forth. And so it's really easy for a lot of these smaller companies to sort of, you know, spend.
Right.
Like putting through with AI, it simplifies it greatly.
Well, obviously. Yeah, no, that's super cool. So as you're plugging the data in and they're getting these reports back, like how do you, I would imagine every investor is looking for different things, right? Like they're kind of looking for a different cue that gives them the magic green light for this particular opportunity. How do you tweak the data? Is it just one flavor that comes out, or are you able to kind of input, hey, this is kind of what we're looking for, these are the attributes we're trying to dive into? Like, how does that work for them?
So we're meeting with a couple of groups and sort of discussing, you know, a couple of other features in terms of more advanced screening and customization. But at this point, a lot of it is screened according to a couple of existing algorithms that we've trained over the years, some of them a little bit newer.
Right.
And the way they're trained is different. And so there's generally one main algorithm that will sort of do the general screening. And then there are other algorithms that will do analysis on some of the alternative factors.
That's awesome.
As people like to dub them. Yeah. And so, and all of that gets pushed to the same interface. All of that can be queried through the same API.
Dude, that is so cool. I mean, honestly, it sounds like what you're doing is like pretty revolutionary in terms of being that specific to discovering the data that really helps them make the decisions they want to. How do you differentiate? Like, are you a mass market product? How are people paying to tap into this knowledge?
I mean, so everybody strives to be a mass market product. I think that in spite of like, you know, like the valuations and the exits and this, that, and the other thing, I think that we're still like doing a lot more individual calls. And so like we'll spend more time, you know, doing larger deals with a couple of companies. And that serves a different set of needs.
This is actually really cool. So if the data, I got to find out though, like, for an investor who's looking into, you know, let's say the $10 to $50 million range fund, they're really doing what would be considered more of a micro investment in terms of just like, they're not going lump sum into, you know, huge deals. Is there enough data within the tools that you're grabbing, that you're pulling the data from, to give them a good analytic of that smaller company that they're investing in? Or, I mean, just help me understand, is it doing more of like a market research saying, hey, this is typical in this industry? Or I don't know, like, I'm just thinking on the end of if I'm a small business looking to raise money, how much information is there on me out there that would actually provide value to an investor to check me out appropriately?
I mean, so this is not designed for companies that are I mean, trying to raise money. Most of these funds are active. Some of them will, you know, sort of be mailing lists. All right. So the way it's broken down is that we simplified it. And so for the most part, you sort of, you know, click on a stock and then it sort of adds it to a list, which is downloadable or uploadable.
Gotcha.
It's kind of like it's like a shopping cart for the stock market.
And
there's a couple of things for analytics. So they can double check all of the factors we've used and sort of see if it meets whatever they're using in terms of what predetermined criteria they like to use outside of the software.
Gotcha.
And the API is a lot more complex. And so basically with the API, they can query, you know, all of the individual factors that are on the display and, you know, additional alternative factors. And so that's really more for, you know, their engineering team than it is for anybody in just doing some of the management.
So we're talking about public companies. We're talking about investing into stocks, not so much into individual companies for a raise or anything like that.
No. And so that's a very different market. And so I think like for that, you know, you're looking at something like Crunchbase or King's Crowd, depending on who you are as an institutional investor. And that's
all right. All right. So my head was out of the game, buddy. I apologize. Okay. So this makes a lot more sense because there is a lot of public data on everything that's publicly traded. So I got you, buddy. I'm on the same page now. So with that being said, the light just clicked. And I'm seeing the light. Okay, this is awesome. So how is this affecting a small fund manager ability to diversify? I mean, this obviously opens up the door to a whole new world of analyzing their opportunities.
In general, it would free up time and it would increase returns. And I think that's sort of like the general idea behind all of it. And initially, like, the sole purpose of all the algorithms when I was trading was literally just to minimize risk, maximize returns. And that's basically what every fund is shooting for, large or small. And then, you know, in terms of maximizing efficacy, the smaller companies tend to be pulled in more directions because it's not, you know, a bunch of large departments who are handling everything. You know, there may be a couple of people doing it. And so you need to really zone in on how time is allocated. And this is designed to be a solution for
that. I love it. Okay. Now, but it's not actually exchanging or doing interchange on the trades. It's just giving you data and pulling in opportunities for you. Maybe within, if you're trying to diversify a fund or what have you, it kind of gives you some options.
Yeah. Actually clearing all of these would be that would be insanely complex. There are a lot of regulations and red tape in the financial industry. And so, you know, this is something we actually talked about earlier. So like in order for us to actually clear all these trades, like every single fund like we worked with would have to be, you know, using equities like across, you know, like four or five different continents. They would be interested in clearing regulations for that. And that is a mountain of paperwork and red tape that is like not necessary.
Totally get it. Yeah, totally get it. Yeah, well, it's smarter just to be that tool, that library of data or aggregator of information for the decisions to be made than it is to just actually be trying to get out there and do it. I mean, you're right. I hope that there's regulations preventing that from happening because that would be kind of scary. Have your money in a fund that's just fully automated.
I mean, for some people, I honestly think like for the quants, like their dream is to have a fully automated fund. Like, the goal is just for like this autonomous fund, but they also have the ability to change and design it. And so for like somebody who doesn't do any of the programming, like the idea of like an AI robot managing all of their money is terrifying.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of the beauty of data itself is because
you
know, like their data is structured in various ways. And, you know, when people like, you know, pay, you know, maybe like $10,000 for one of these, you know, lengthy investment reports, they're basically just getting a recommendation and a bunch of data on
there.
So when everything is sort of there and it's just the outputs, the underlying value of the data is the same. It's the same as the existing stock price. It's the same as whatever data is out there. It's just much more simpler to utilize and execute on. And that's sort of beauty of financial data in general, is that you can condense a lot of value into something very, very simple and streamlined.
Love it. Okay, Sean, now we're clear on what you do. And who you do it for makes a lot more sense now. Talk to me about your actual business. What, you know, you've been doing this for how long? How long have you been kind of building this engine?
Five and a half years, roughly. I think that we really focused on the engine for the last, you know, I want to say like 3 or so years.
Love it. Okay. This is cool. So 5.5 years in, 3 years actually like diving into the algorithm of the AI, I'm guessing. And then walk me through, like, looking back on it, what's been kind of some of the key decisions you've had to make as the guy to build the company and see it grow the way it has to this point?
Various. And so, all right. So the AI has actually been sort of under development the entire 5.5 years. The display, the app, the API, that's more like the last three and a half years.
Right.
So I think in terms of key decisions, for us specifically, it was sort of a balancing act. And that's because when you're managing a company that's on the smaller side, you really have to choose between being a fund and being a startup. And so the way that both the corporate structures will raise capital differently, and then the money is utilized in a different way. And so like when you're a startup, you're going for evaluation, you're going for, you know, money to burn, and then you're going for an exit or some kind of an IPO or liquidity event.
Sure.
When you're
a
fund, you're taking a management fee, and then you are essentially just going to try and increase the value of the fund.
Sure,
and the growth rate is very, very different for both types of companies, as is sort of like the eventual return. And so I think that sort of choosing that direction was a crossroads that we really started going through, I'd say like circa like 2021. The accelerator. And a lot of the decisions we made were based on becoming more of a startup than a...
Love it. Love it. So that makes a lot of sense. Now, I got to guess that somewhere in the mix there, your decision to go straight to a fund manager, and I've heard you mention the API several times, like building an API so that they can essentially embed it into their tool set was a big deal for you. Why was that? I mean, I'm guessing that was a pretty big decision to make.
Yeah. So it was essentially rescaling the model. And so any of the API features and the interface, that's really sort of a reflection on some of the things we initially used for live trading and portfolio management. And then they are much more simple than a lot of the backend algorithms we used to run. But that's also because sort of what you develop as a user facing product generally looks much simpler than it is.
Gotcha.
And that's sort of the beauty of tech.
Nice. I see it. That's really cool. You know, I've talked to a lot of tech founders before, and it is always a big decision to decide, do we want to be a portal that people log into and utilize, or do we want to be an API based, let's just plug in and send them the data wherever they want it type of an application process? And it sounds like, are you doing a little bit of both, or is it primarily just they want to do the queries and build it and then we just pump the data?
So both. And this is actually because the majority of trading brokerages that these companies will use, we'll have both. And so a lot of brokerages will have some kind of an API for automatic execution. And this is something their development team wants would use. And,
Love it.
But they would also have sort of like their own software that, you know, they would use and sort of, you know, I guess kind of screen things that way. But the truth about a lot of the brokerage software out there is that it's pretty choppy and it's pretty slow. And that's because...
I would imagine.
Yeah. So because the goal of the brokerage is to have people like place a trade and then they take a commission on it. And so it's not so much designed about, you know, efficacy in general as it is sort of incentivizing, you know, the clearing.
Right. And probably incentivizing multiple exchanges as opposed to one giant one.
Yeah. Like there are actually a handful of brokerages that will actually have the regulatory requirements to clear international equities. Most of them will do maybe like one country specifically.
Right. So now walk me through this. As you've been building this and you've been growing it and adoption has taken place and you're finding a home in all these other people's platforms, any big red flags? Like what are some challenges that have popped up that you weren't really anticipating besides everything?
I mean, I guess so. If you ask, you know, like the average founder that question, it's kind of like when things start growing, like everything happens everywhere all at once. And like the world sort of like explodes, and it's exploding in a good way, but it's just like all of a sudden, like you're staring at like a mountain of contracts, you know, like you're talking to like, you know, the press. You've probably never done that before. And, you know, everything really does happen everywhere all at once. And, I think that it ultimately depends on the company and the direction they want to take. And so like in 2022, when we were racking up a stack of NDAs from investment banks, when my friend sent me this meme photo of Freddie Mercury sucking the world in through a straw, and it said, you know, like, may your Mercury be a little more Freddie and a little less retrograde. And I think that it's funny because it's true. It's like, you know, it looks very different on the outside. And so on the outside, you know, people are like, wow, like, look at how successful and wonderful this is. And on the inside, you're like, oh my God, like, how are these numbers real? What is happening? How are there so many people? What am I supposed to do with this? Like, you know, all of a sudden, like, you know, everything jumps, the number of employees jumps, your valuation jumps, this, that, and the other thing. And like, you know, there's something about actually growing, and then it's not a linear process. It's very much exponential. And so during that process, there were a mountain of decisions in various directions.
I love it. No, that's super cool. You know, it is exciting. And you're right. When things do start to move, the train starts moving, all of a sudden you're discovering all sorts of stuff that you didn't realize while the train was sitting there, right? And it's just like all the little bumps along the track, you're just like, oh crap, that thing's going to fall over. And oh my gosh, look at that over there. And there's so many messes to clean up. But, you know, gauging by the fact that you're where you are today and you've had the success you've had today, you know, and you don't have to share the answer of what this is, but I'm curious, do you know to what end you're building this? Like, do you have an exit in mind that you're building towards with this business?
So I had an exit in mind. And so now I think I have a much more balanced view on startup exits. And so you know, the exit in mind was in 2022, but in 2023, you know, I figured, you know, like, sell it at 13 million, be done, take all of it, you know, and then just throw it back on the stock market for the rest of my life. And then I realized basically how private equity exits are broken down. And so exits are very complicated. IPOs are somewhat complicated as well. Right. Although I think that, you know, it's, you know, a little bit different. Most companies are going to exit via. Some of them will go public, but, you know, a company can still fail if it's public. And so oftentimes it would be better to just sell it. But then there's the terms of the exit. And so at this point, I think that I prefer to be a little bit more patient with things because I understand that the numbers are relative.
Your exit is
relative to how much money you've raised and on what terms and what your ownership percentage is. And then it's also based on what the acquiring company is going to offer. And, you know, acquiring companies can essentially write up whatever they feel like writing.
Pretty
much. And like, and things are going to get redlined. People are going to send it back and forth. There's going to be a lengthy negotiation. But all of these factors come into play. So my idea of is, you know, how to exit now is just when the timing is right and when I think that, you know, the best outcome can be achieved. Because actually pushing for an exit too early is eventually like very, very harmful and honestly kind of self-destructive. And that's because, and like, so first of all, like most companies just want to be sold. You know, like that's every startup founder's dream is to get an exit. And then I think that, you know, the people who've actually done it, like, realize that, like, you may actually be staying on board with the company for a number of years after the exit and so on and so forth. And so the irony is that the exit is not actually the end game. It's what happens after the exit, and it might be years after the exit that is the end game. And so because of that, and because a lot of the company's value is based on the financial markets itself, you know, I can essentially just sit on the IP for as long as I need to. And, you know, if I was listed for sale when I was like 29 and I'm 31 at this point, you know, if I just, you know, grow a stock portfolio for another decade or whatever, you know, like the IP is there, it's registered with the Library of Congress, and it's an intangible asset. So it can sit there while I deal with everything else. And
totally.
I prefer to be a little bit more zen about it now.
It's smart.
But that also depends on the investors. And so you got to understand that, like, so private equity investors, they want returns, but they don't need them to be as large and fast as venture investors. And so the balance in the game really is that, you know, it's the type of investor and what they're on board with. And so like if someone raises a ton of venture capital, like they need to clear that in 5 to 10 years because the VCs are supposed to return a multiple right. of the initial fund. And if not, then right. they're out of business. And so right. there's a lot of factors that sort of go into, you know, the exits. And the thing is that, you know, entrepreneurs and investors may not actually have as much leverage with the acquiring company as a lot of people think that they do. And that's something that these guys really don't want to say.
Sure.
But also, I don't think it's something that really comes to mind for somebody who hasn't raised or, you know, like sort of dealt with exit negotiations.
Sure, sure.
But yeah, it's a very, very complicated chess.
Well, I was very curious the question because, you know, I think a lot of our listening audience, they do kind of, they're very myopic and they just kind of think about the one thing of like, I just want to get this thing launched. And then it's like, okay, I just want to see if I can grow this thing. And I think that there's very few founders who do think that far ahead to say, well, what is my exit strategy? And I'm glad to hear that you had one. It doesn't mean that you have to execute on it, you know, when the time comes, but to see that you've been able to kind of look at it, evaluate it and say, huh, I think I'm gonna be a little more patient because look what could happen with 3 or 5 more years of moving this fast. And so I think that for those listening, this is a huge, huge, this is a great example of someone who had a mission, had a vision of where he thought it could go, what the exit could potentially look like, and then reevaluate. You don't have to do what you envision. You can move the vision a little bit if you want to. And Sean, I think that's really awesome of you to share that with us because it is something a lot of people stress out about. And to your point, it can kind of cripple you sometimes in your decision-making when everything is geared towards this hypothetical situation that you're not even faced with at that moment sometimes. So that's awesome.
Yeah. And that's very much the entrepreneurial journey.
Right.
And I
right.
think that it's easier to be more balanced as you have more experience and sort of at the later stages. Nobody's thinking about this during the you know, 2-3 years.
No, they should be, but they're not.
I mean, yeah. And the other thing is just like, my honest opinion now is it's almost only fair to expect so much from
agreed.
You know, people who are, you know, earlier stage entrepreneurs, because it's like, there aren't always a ton of answers. And, you know, like right. sometimes right. the answers are right. Sometimes they're wrong. Sometimes they come from companies you work
agreed.
With, board members or advisors or co-founders, yep. whatever. But there's always multiple avenues. And the avenues and the directions sort of, you know, change with time.
Well, Sean, I love the input you've given our audience today. I honestly, the business model is so cool. It's such a helpful thing. I love hearing about people's application of AI in anything, but this is a really smart play. And I think obviously, you know what you're doing. You've registered the IP. You've done what you need to protect yourself here. Very cool stuff. I'm very proud of you. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with our audience today. And we can't wait to see what happens moving forward. So cool.
Thanks. It was fun being here.
Great. And for the rest of you, we'll catch you on the next episode, but take a listen and re-listen to this episode because I think there's some valuable gems in here. And Sean, we appreciate you, man.
I appreciate you as well. And I hope the audience gets something out of this.
Awesome. Hey, we hope you enjoyed that episode. As with all of our guests that we've enjoyed on this podcast, we hope you take a minute to reflect on how relevant was that to your growth journey? How relevant is that to your business? If you are not taking steps to grow and scale your business, chances are you're not growing or scaling. So how do you know if you're growth ready? Check it out at growthreadiness.com. If you haven't done so already, we have a free assessment at growthreadiness.com. That's right, growthreadiness.com. And measure up to see if you truly are growth ready. If that magical amount of funding or that magical client popped into your doorstep today, would you be ready? Could you grow and scale your business with what you've got ready right now? Chances are there are some places you're strong, there's some places you're weak. We let you explore that for free at growthreadiness.com. Click on the assessment at the top right, and we challenge everyone that listens to the podcast to go see how growth ready your business is from your perspective as an owner, founder, operations director, or even a sales manager. Is your company on a path to growth readiness? If it's not, reach out, let us know what we can do to help. We have tons of resources, tons of free stuff, and some really, really high quality paid stuff that's going to help your company reach that level of growth that you hoped it could be on. Whether you're aiming for exit, whether you're aiming for a fundraise, or whether you're just trying to sustain the growth you've already had, go to growthreadiness.com and check out what you're doing and if it's working for you. Thanks for being a part of the Growth and Scaling podcast. We hope all these interviews are helping you determine the best path for your growth and giving you real-world examples of what you could be doing in your business today.